Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Decorating Pages podcast presents Production Design Film Study. This class examines Oscar-nominated films spanning a century of cinema. Accomplished professionals in production design will explore and dissect the sets featured in these nominated films and will educate why they were recognized for the design of their time. This class features the films of 1975. And this year's films are reviewed by Kim Wanup, set decorator, and Adam Rao, production designer. So we jumped a decade to 1975.
Time travel.
Yeah. And I feel like, what a difference. I feel like there's a huge difference in the way things were shot.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah. The way things are shot, the style of shooting, and I don't know. I thought it was interesting of what a decade can do for you.
It was such a good study in like what progress comes. I almost would say I'm not going to do it. But it would be amazing to then jump to 85 and then 95 and then 2005 and just see, you know, that it's a great way to study human culture, American culture, and how we've changed so much. Like, what I really am seeing clearly in watching movies, or at least 1965, 1975, is that storytelling has adjusted to be more and more international or more and more global in current market. And almost waters down the like unique story. I mean, I really enjoyed every movie that I watched. If I didn't love it, I still enjoyed the story of it. And I find that current contemporary movie making in the big scale is not as compelling. Yeah. I'm enjoying watching older movies than I am watching newer movies, Barbie aside.
Because
they're pulling me in and they're telling me a story and they're doing it in ways that settle. I find that current movies use close-up and they use edit and then scenes are quicker and they're so worried about audience attention deficit that they change tone or they change things up, where there's something so refreshing about the, you know, the style of some of these older movies where you sit in them. And yes, they get boring. That does happen. But that's a different kind of entertainment factor that you have to adjust your brain to. I really, truly loved it. And that kind of came out of watching a decade and then another decade. Yeah.
I feel exactly the same way, in the sense that the storytelling is more focused on the story and the writing than now is more like the effects or the acting or like, I don't know. It's just there. I think that there were better stories, especially the 70s. I love the 70s movies. I think that's the pinnacle. But, you know, where everything sort of came together and everything looks better. I don't know. I'm a big fan of the 70s. So I was happy to do this.
I find a lot of I only know what I know now because that's the industry that I work in, or what I, you know, now is what I'm working in. And I find that you sit into any production meeting or any concept meeting and they say, we want something like, and they use an adjacent movie or something. And because I look at these movies and they had their own style and maybe they were saying, let's make something like. But I watch, for instance, the Hindenburg.
Yeah, let's start
Shampoo,
with the Hindenburg. Yeah.
And they have their own tone. They seem to stand alone in their own little 2-hour or 3-hour moment. And that's the Hindenburg. And they gave you this movie and that's what it was. And it wasn't trying to be, then let's start with the Hindenburg. Yeah. I actually think the Hindenburg should have won the Oscar. That is I'll say that right off the bat. I thought the Hindenburg was spectacular.
I actually watched it last because I was like, I don't want to watch this German thing and the Hindenburg. It's going to be depressing. I don't want to watch it. I was in tears by the end of the film. I loved it. I was like, wow. And then I deep dived into the Hindenburg and how many people actually died.
Me too.
Oh my God. I was fantastic. I loved it.
So let's Let's start at the end of the movie. I mean, we don't have to go too much in plot because if anybody knows history, they know what happens to the Hindenburg. So it's like watching the Titanic or watching any documentary like about Katrina. Like, you know what happens, and it's the story that is being told and the lens in which they used to do it. My takeaway was that they made it like a spy movie, and I really liked that. You know, you had the spy movie vibe going on the whole time.
They used actual footage of the Hindenburg exploding, intertwined with the movie, and the director made a decision to show the end of the movie in black and white, specifically so it would match the news reel that they had, which I thought
they wanted to make the whole movie in black and white, but the studio Universal said no. And that, you know, we probably read the same article that they grayed out the color. So it actually does give you the experience of almost black and white adjacent, I would say. And then the ending with the tragedy that did occur, and then the very end of the movie, they play the real radio footage.
Yeah.
I also cried, and I don't cry at movies very often, but that was so successfully and beautifully done.
So
it was absolutely wonderful. And then I actually thought that the end of the Titanic, you know, when it's sinking, I felt like James Cameron must have watched the Hindenburg, because like I was like this interesting like documentary and then real life and then pulling on your heartstrings and then releasing your heartstrings.
Probably.
That's kind of how that was happening. And then, you know, you were watching, they show you footage, and then they kind of pause it for a second, and then a scene continues to play. It's like it almost elongates the tragedy. Like, it really, you know, lets you see the scenes that would have been going on at that time.
Oh, yeah.
Or in the 30 seconds or 2 minutes or 5 minutes, whatever.
Well, there was a note that I read that the actual burning of it lasted like 9 seconds. But in the movie, it's like it's like 3.5 minutes or something. Like,
yeah, and I like that. It slowed it down. Yeah. It was like slow motion, but different than slow motion, because you could see all these scenes that would have happened in that 9 seconds or whatever. And that was what I loved. And then, okay, so that part aside, how gaga were you about the set decoration in the Hindenburg itself? Like,
I was like, wait, this is awesome. I understand why people would want to go up in a balloon, because it was like high style, like almost like a ship. Like, it was like art deco. It had beautiful wall paintings in their dining room, these little tiny like vignettes of, like, I don't know, they look like Dutch paintings on a wall or something. I thought it was fantastic. It was just something I had never thought of, and then they got to decorate it, which I thought was fantastic. Like,
well, everybody, when the Hindenburg came out, I'm assuming, would have been curious to know what it was. I mean, it's like when the space shuttle, like, people want to know what's inside. That's just part of our inherent human curiosity. It's like, what's inside Frodo's house? You can't help but wonder. And here is the Hindenburg. And now there's a chance for a movie to show you what it looked like inside, whether it's accurate or not. I was really surprised to read that it was not well received and that it did not do well. It only got one star from Roger Ebert or whichever one. But from my point of view, it was one of the best movies I've seen in a while. And I don't know why it resonated so much with me, but I loved it.
I think there is a detail of Anne Bancroft lighting her cigarette with the lighter comes out of the wall. That must have been true. And for me, you're in a gas balloon, and for a lighter to come out of the wall is like, oh yeah, that's how they used to make the baby cages out the window to get fresh air. Like, things they don't think about that had to have been true.
She even kind of flippantly says, they only give us one of these, and then she pulls it to light her own
she
cigarette.
Pulls it out of the wall to light her cigarette.
And then the kids leaning over when the lightning's going off, and the kids can like the
lightning
fall
storm
out the window.
Wait, I have a note about that lightning storm. Oh, I forget.
St. Elmo's fire. I didn't know that.
Wait, the Hindenburg model took 3 to 4 months to build. It cost $35,000, which would be $200,000 now. The set of the ship's hull cost $65,000 and was built by 80 men in a total of 70,000 work hours, using 8 tons of aluminum, 11,000 yards of muslin, 24,000 feet of cord, and 2 million rivets. A 24-hour guard was put on stage 12 at Universal to guard the set because it was so expensive.
Well, and I read too that like they basically worked around the clock because they were pressed up against time, and it took a year. I mean, a year of production. I don't know at what point they were building, but there's so many great shots of it too that you get to enjoy. And inside and out. I mean, the technological feats that they had to jump over to show the outside of it floating, and they, when they get too close to the iceberg, and that whole scene where they're, you know, repairing its muslin skin.
That's incredible.
It did kind of make me wonder why the movie didn't do well. Like, did this, was this movie ahead of its time? Are we stupider? Like, what's going on? Like, why was this movie not well received? And the fact that still to this day they don't actually know why it blew up, I found to be interesting.
Yeah, there's many conspiracy theories of like if the Nazis did it on their own, or it was like, I don't know. There's a lot of conspiracies. The set also collapsed while inspectors were inspecting it, and there were no injuries, but production was halted for a month while they rebuilt some of the set. It cost $15 million to make and was the most expensive film of 1975. It's crazy.
And it didn't make its money back, or did it? Do you know?
I don't think it did.
Well, this says
the budget was, the budget was $15 million, and then it doesn't even have it on here, but I think I read that too, that it was like a bust. Yeah.
Well, Edward Cofagno and Frank R. McClevy. Hats off, because like, even though the movie wasn't that well done or well received, I thought that scenery was amazing, and it completely, obviously it's a movie about a thing, so the thing better be awesome, and it was.
Yeah. I also agree, after watching it, I was like, whoa, this was, I mean, the build on this is fucking amazing. And then when we compare it to The Winner, it is, I don't know. This is like real design or something. I don't know.
I will agree with you that, like, we'll talk about The Winner last, obviously, but I felt that this should have won, and there should have almost been no debate. Mm. Now, learning more about what did win and how it won, I'm like, okay, I kind of get it. But the Hindenburg really, I think it's lead weight was that the movie wasn't received well. Had it been received well and people really got behind it, I could see why it would have won.
Yeah. The Man Who Would Be King is designed by Alexander Trauner and Tony Ingalls, and set decoration by Peter James. Again, a movie I would have never watched. Loved it.
Oh, you did love it. I didn't really love it. I got bored. But I will say, hats off to set deck and props. Like, all the instrumentation and the animals. My God, the animals. There's snakes and scorpions and everything is in it.
I just thought it was something different. And having it being made in the 70s, again, going back to, like, stories you don't know. And then, like, they made great stories out of myths or legends or, you know, actual happenings. I thought, like, just the scenery of it all, like the castles, and then like that room of gold that they go into was fantastic. And then showing all the like shanty towns, like all the poor little like tent places, and then they were in like, I don't know, the Himalayas, or they were like, oh yeah, no, the mountains,
like the sense of place and the spirit that they captured, and it wasn't just cliche. Like, you really did feel, and there had to have been a Steven Spielberg moment where he watches and goes, oh, that's how I want to do bridge. Indiana Jones.
Yeah, look at that, because bridge.
You really see the building blocks for Indiana Jones, and I don't know what this production designer's, you know, heritage or production designer's heritage is, but, like, it's clear that they were very good at sense of place, and they made you feel like you went out of this world. Every time there was a market, they knocked it out of the park. Like, all of them were great.
And they had to build that bridge. They built that bridge. They tore it down.
And I read a really interesting article about how Sean Connery is afraid of heights.
Yeah, and he had the stuntman.
The stuntman fell 80 feet.
Yeah.
That's crazy. 80 feet is, that's, what is that, 8 stories?
That's a lot.
I have a hard time looking over 3 stories. 8 stories. That's crazy.
Yeah. I love Sean Connery. I love Michael Keaton is good and bad, but I just thought it was interesting. And again, I think I got to, like, I'm surprised at these movies I never saw and I like.
Well, I actually liked the, again, it had very good social commentary. Would this movie get made nowadays? I bet not.
No.
Because, you know, it definitely is about the British taking over, and, you know, it's got entitlement. It's got all these things. It's satirizing in a really interesting way. I think the last 45 minutes of the movie were outstanding. It was the, like, traveling to that kind of made me bored. Oh. And I never really understood the contract that they made. Like, that felt like a weird part of the story.
Oh, in the beginning, when they're talking to that guy. Yeah. We're just going to go. Like, we're going to be. So the plot, we should say, is two former British soldiers in 1880s India declare to set themselves up as kings in Kazakhstan, a land where no white man has set foot since Alexander the Great. So basically, they go in there trying to, like, pretend that they're gods. Or, like, they believe that the one guy is a god because of, like, a misunderstanding with an arrow. And they're kings, and they're treated like kings. But then one of them gets bored. And, I mean, it's directed by John Huston. It's, like, it's a good movie, I thought. Oh, I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, it had romping adventure and satire were all there. It just, interestingly enough, it didn't nab me. Maybe it was because it was in the shadow of the Hindenburg.
Production design wise, I could see why this would be, it's, you know, they're all over the map. It's India. It's like, I don't know. I thought it was, it's.
Yeah, the train station scene alone is worth it. That production design of that is really well. And then the train and the fact that there's no glass and, like, they made this, everything about that movie is believably out of this world. And that is what I respected the most.
Shampoo.
Okay, Shampoo. I actually texted you after I watched it and was like,
I know,
I did, but then I thought about it. It stuck with me. So the movie, when I watched it, I was kind of like ho-humming, but I never fast-forwarded. I watched every second of it. Do you want to tell the plot before I dive in?
On Election Day 1968, a hairdresser and ladies' man is too busy cutting hair and dealing with various girlfriends and his mistress, whose husband he meets and finds out he's having an affair with.
It's basically a womanizer movie set in LA.
And I
talked to my friend Vincent Jeffords, who's a production designer. He did Criminal Minds forever, and now he does NCSI Hawaii or whatever one is in Hawaii. He grew up in this timeline in Brentwood, and he was telling me how much of a love letter it is to locations. And once I kind of thought about it in through that lens, I was like, oh, it really does. It's very cunning. It makes you love Los Angeles, and it shows you a very beautiful lens of Los Angeles. There's no homeless people. There's no graffiti. There's no trash. There's no smog.
What are you talking about? There's plenty of smog. That's what I was going to say. You can't even see out that guy's window when he's in his Wilshire office.
Oh yeah, that's right. The whole thing is smog. But they don't, like, you're right. But they're not, like, dwelling on it. Like, they're making LA look beautiful, and the location. Yeah. So here's who wins in the Oscar if they were to win, is the location department. I know that the production designer, I'm sure, was collaborating. I'm not saying they weren't, but the locations are spectacular. And you know, the pool that has the jacuzzi and the waterfall, and I just really enjoyed it, but it's very contained. It's not like it's sprawling.
Well, Goldie's house was a set. Let's just
without a doubt. Set.
It's very period. It's white, the white and the yellow and the Victorian piece throwbacks and the brass bed. And, like, it's a time capsule. It's a very good research set, actually.
Go ahead. I was going to say the salon is the perfect time capsule. It's, like, of that moment, hot flash at that time.
Ferns, lattice, white brick. There's so many plants in that salon. He actually bumps into one and one of the takes.
Let's talk about that for a second, because there were a couple of times in many of these movies, but that movie particularly, where shit's in the way and the DP doesn't pull it out. And I loved that. There's a couple of times in a couple of movies where something is in the way that's completely blocking the face of the actor or the camera, and it doesn't get moved. Any project I've worked on now, they'd be like, get rid of the coffee table, pull the lamp off, get rid of the plant. It's just like, you just want to slice people's hands off. Be like, just let it be. It feels better that way, in my opinion.
The Carrie Fisher's bedroom with that blue paisley wall, the whole thing is wallpapered, which is another nod to the 70s, I think, even though this is supposed to be 68. And now that I'm thinking about that, I'm like, this is so 70s. How is this? I don't know. but I don't know.
Oh, right. The only thing that makes it period is the election night, which I still don't understand why they did that. Like, that was such a big part of the plot, but it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't do anything for the plot. It doesn't matter.
I think at the time it did. Like, I was reading a little bit more about it, and it was very social commentary of what happened to Nixon. I don't understand it because I don't know the history of that. But I did love that it was a time capsule. Even his motorcycle and him running through the hills and Goldie's apartment, which you talked about. There's like 10 lamps in her apartment that I love.
There's great and lamps. The fact that
everybody has to keep moving the phone because there's only one phone. I thought that was really clever.
So I think contemporary-wise and showing the date, the 1975, it's a good-looking movie. I did not really like the movie at all.
It's... sells LA in such a magical way that I think even to this day, Los Angeles wants to entice you. That's its, you know, New York has its attraction, and Atlanta or Denver, you can pick any city. They all have a PR campaign. That's their heritage. Yeah. And LA, it's very clear in that movie that it just wants you to, you want to be a part of it, you know?
Yeah. So yeah, the Sunshine Boys, should we move on?
Yeah, Sunshine Boys.
Sunshine Boys is a vaudeville duo agree to reunite for a television special, but it turns out they can't stand each other. It's a Neil Simon play. He also wrote the screenplay, and it stars Walter Matthau and George Burns. To me, you could totally tell this was a play because the sets are so... everything's set in a set. Like, it's... I mean, I don't know. They did some exteriors, but not many.
No, you're right. Everything's set in a set. The other thing I really loved about it, which, you know, you could say as production design or not, or set decoration or props, is that pretty much everybody's doing something. Even in the advertisement agency, everybody's got a thing to do. And I love that in movies because, you know, resets are difficult. They take time. You know, people make a sandwich. You got to reset the sandwich.
Yeah, yeah.
People make coffee. They're always moving around. They're always reading the newspaper. They're always smoking a cigarette. They're always reading a book. They're moving things, which I loved. I loved that about the movie because it makes it tangible and relatable. But you're right. It's very, very setty and it feels that way. But set decorator, I can see why they were nominated. The layering that's going on in the apartment.
Marvin March, who is a fantastic, amazing set decorator who died a couple years ago. I loved Walter Matthau's. It's this New York apartment. It's has every, you know, flyer of every show he ever has somewhere, or some telegram he got, or like an old prop is over there, and, you know, the blankets on the sofa. Like, he's an old man who's lived in this apartment forever, and it's just a chunk full of his own history and character. I thought it was great. I thought the agency was great with that oval arch. I don't know if that's a location. That's a location? Is that what you said?
Oh, no, I don't know that. I was just going to say I noticed that as well. Yeah. It was a nice signature. You know, the audience needs to know where they are in little moments like that. Yeah. You go like, oh, where am I? I'm in a fancy office, that kind of thing.
I thought when they went to do the television show together, and then like the set build was even good, just to show like the viewer, like the behind the scenes of the camera, their teeny tiny dressing room, I thought was really good. What else?
Really get to enjoy the George Burns character's space that well. Like, there's almost, it's clearly a location, and there's almost nothing, to me, there was almost nothing about it that it defined him. I mean, granted, he was living with his daughter, but you get to go to, they make fun of New Jersey or the Bronx,
Jersey.
You don't really get that joke because they mention it a bunch of times. But even the way that Walter Matthau's character's pictures are hung shows you that the set decorating team was very tuned into how they were going to do this, because they're kind of wacky and the frames don't match and a little bit off, and they had to smack somebody's hand to keep from straightening things out, because it's almost like the apartment's almost feeling like it's sinking at certain parts, you know, which I love.
There's they also got to shoot in the Friars Club, the real Friars Club in New York.
Which is the TV set?
No, it's where the nephew goes to try to convince his uncle to do the show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, He's playing cards. And stuff like that. That is a great set, too.
No, yeah. I mean, again, there was a lot of ferns. There was a lot of plants and everything around.
But my last note on it was like, Great movie, not amazing. Yeah. Not the Hindenburg.
Not the Hindenburg. It was George Burns' comeback movie. Walter Matthau is 55 and 80, and George Burns is 80.
That's wild. Of course they are.
In 1975, he was 80.
He must have grayed Walter Matthau's hair down. It was interesting to read who was originally supposed to be cast. There was a bunch of different people they tried to get to those roles.
Yeah. It was good. I mean, I feel like I have seen that movie before, or parts of it before, but never saw the whole thing. And it's good. It's a different type of comedy. Like, it is a throwback, and it is a good... it is a good little movie, I thought. So
yeah, I would say Saturday night, Friday night, looking for something enjoyable. I laughed out loud a few times. We'll laugh out loud, Walter Matthau. But it does, it was like, oh, he got typecast because Grumpier Old Men and The Odd Couple, like that just becomes his thing for a while.
Yeah. So let's talk about the winner. The winner for production design was Barry Lyndon, and that was production designer Ken Adam and Roy Walker, and set decorator Vernon Dixon. I have never liked this movie. I did not want to rewatch it again. And I found myself actually liking it more than I used to, but I'm a Kubrick fan. I just don't, I'm not into this movie.
Yeah, what I liked about it was seeing that Stanley Kubrick could do this movie.
Yeah.
You know, comparing it to The Shining or Clockwork Orange, like it's awesome to see range, because as an artist, as we both are, producers often want to typecast you and they want to say, oh, that's what this person does. And here's a director who did something so different and they made it their own. I would say that I was not really sure about it either. I was not excited about watching it. First of all, it's way too long.
Yeah.
I did say eat your heart out locations, because you get to see a ton of stuff. And I'm sure you looked up on Wikipedia that it was a challenge. They tried to shoot it in Ireland and then...
Yeah, they had to keep moving locations. They had to reshoot stuff. It took over 300 days of filming. It had two major shutdowns because of like the Irish war that was going. They had to move locations. They had to move out of the country, I think. So,
but the thing that I love the most is that they were able to connect to NASA somehow and use these really specialty lenses that had to be modified to shoot natural light, candlelit. Mm. And I think that's what ultimately made it win the Oscar. It was the production designer, Ken Adams, who convinced Stanley Kubrick to move to Ireland and not shoot it in England. And the rooms are amazing. I mean, you just love seeing all the rooms. You just love it. That is the highlight of the movie, is just seeing these outrageous rooms.
Yeah, these beautiful rooms. It's like you're at Versailles. It's like small versions of Versailles, but they're huge.
And there's this one mirror that gets used in two different sets that's like, it's got to be 25 feet tall, continuous mirror. And it's just like, as a person who goes into beautiful rooms and says, okay, grips, we're going to be in here, I would have been like, please don't break the mirror. Please don't. Don't try to
don't
gimbal
it.
Just leave the mirror
alone. Don't gimbal it. This movie is about an Irish rogue who wins the heart of a rich woman and assumes her dead husband's aristocratic position in 18th century England. They only cast Ryan O'Neill because he had come off of like Love Story and they thought it would be a big hit. The movie costs $11 million and only made $234,000. Ever.
It's because it's Zeus best, yeah.
Ever.
So but that's... I will say the use of the wide shot
is
really awesome. And that again feeds into how this movie won an Oscar for that. Interesting. So it bombed.
Yeah.
And yet it wins an Oscar for production design. That fascinates me.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, no electrical lighting was used. They were only candlelit scenes. They were custom-made candles. Each candle had three wicks, which I know that now because I found to do that. And which the three wicks result in a much brighter blaze, but it also burns quicker, just so if anybody knows. I loved looking at all the chandeliers with the candles. I mean, that's scary to me, but it's such a period thing when you see that and you're like, oh my gosh, they had to lower these chandeliers to put the candles on and pull them back up. Like it's
this crazy. Movie definitely had stuff in the way of actors and in the way of the camera, and I loved it every second of it. The camera would go behind something or, you know, hide, and it wasn't to me always done about tone. You know, sometimes you make a camera half hidden, so it looks like you're voyeuring, so you're looking at someone behind something. That wasn't what this was doing. That this was just like getting you into a sense of space of this room and beautiful composition.
Yeah, I mean the camera work is phenomenal. Did it win for cinematography? Let me look up.
300 days of filming. Wow, that's a long time for this movie because
Yeah.
it's a lot of people sitting and talking.
And I know, yes, it won for cinematography, John Alcott. I also think that Ryan O'Neal loses his accent here and there. Like I was laughing out loud of like he's not even paying attention. He's got
True,
like
no, and
one
he does go
job.
any outie, and they put a lot of stock in his beautiful face, but even that wears out after a while. It's like,
Yeah.
okay, we need something else going
Yeah.
on here.
I don't know if I have any other notes. I mean, it was the only Best Picture nominee that year to also be nominated for original song score, adaptation score, costume design, and art direction. This Ken is it? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead, finish.
The
Sorry.
production designer Ken Adams also did Dr. Strangelove. He has won a previous Oscar for The Madness of King George. Or he also won for Madness of King George, which was 1994. He also has a ADG Lifetime Achievement Award for the 007 series that he did.
That's Ken Adams.
Yeah.
So all this, just to recap, audience at home, Barry Lyndon, the Hindenburg, the man who would be king, Shampoo and the Sunshine Boys, there to me was such an obvious scale difference. I mean, obviously the Hindenburg, we've talked about it, we loved it, but it's such a bigger movie than any of these other ones. So it is very interesting to me that it didn't win because it's in a league of its own when it comes to scale of scenery versus what the other ones were.
But if you also consider that in this year, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Funny Lady, The Four Musketeers, and Day of the Locusts were also out. Like, Sunshine Boys and not Funny Lady? Like, do you know what I
You know,
mean?
that's a good point. That is a very good point. I shouldn't disqualify the man who would be king because that does have a lot of scale. I would say that is equal in scale, trying to compare apples to apples. But you're right, One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest not getting in there because that had such a style to it.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of shocking to me. I mean, I only looked at pictures of Day of the Locust. It looked a big scale, but Cuckoo, Funny Lady, and Four Musketeers. Well, Four Musketeers was a big scale too. Like, I don't know. It's funny how things get nominated
It
sometimes.
is, and so much of it, I mean, we both know, sadly, is related to PR and just how well something catches traction. Like, I use Emily in Paris as a good example because I liked season one and it didn't really get a lot of attention. And then, now it's being nominated for things and it's getting a lot more attention. But it took 2 or 3 seasons. Things We Do in the Shadow, similarly, like it
Yes.
takes a while for some of these things to catch on. I still cannot believe that Severance, is it? The
Yeah.
Apple, how did that not get
Where is
nominated for an
it?
Emmy?
Where is
It
it?
blows my mind that it's so well done, but that's what happens. They need time to get to things because we're so saturated. That's my theory.
Well, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest won Best Picture that year. And I believe, now, usually, which is more modern, the winner of cinematography wins art direction.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But cinematography went to Barry Lyndon, but Cuckoo's Nest was nominated for that too. Yeah, I don't know. It's a good year.
Yeah, no, it is. So tell me, what are you doing next? Are you jumping back around? Are you going into another movie? Like, how are you? Because there's lessons for you to learn too as you go through the time periods. Like, what do
Well,
you
I'll tell you this. I did 1992 with my buyer Howard, and we were talking before about like if a movie doesn't catch on, but the design is good, and that is the year that Toys was nominated for production design, and it's a horrible movie, and it bombed, and it's a horrible movie, and Howard's End won that year. Now, to me, Toys is a better design film than Howard's
Yeah.
End, even though it's a shitty movie. So there's a real discussion there of, like we were saying, the popularity of a movie versus what are we voting on for design? What are we really, because you love the movie. I loved everything about it. I loved Howard's End. I loved it. I'm going to vote for it. Or is it like, oh, I'm really going to separate myself from this shit and really look at like this innovative type of like a toy factory house, you know, sleeping quarters, like everything, dining room, like all of those weirdo sets.
We have the luxury of looking back at something. So maybe we can separate those to a certain degree. And so it's a good lesson to use as we vote for the Emmys here coming shortly.
Yeah.
Like we have to learn, we got to separate. And that is a hard thing to do, to give our attention to something that is warranted.
Yeah.
Versus something that is popular.
But I do in this, and especially this year, being lucky to talk to a lot of nominees of something that I maybe would cast aside of a show, and then hearing like, oh, you built all that? Wow, that was nuts. Why did you build all that? Or, oh my God, that sounds like a horrible location. You basically had to build it anyway. Why did you go to a location? Or, oh, you had over 250 sets? That's crazy. So to me, even doing the podcast myself and listening to it, I've checked myself in my voting ritual of like, well, they did do a lot of work there, even though it's not my cup of tea. Like I can see why this should win or this should be nominated. And it's not all like House of Dragon. You know what I mean? You really got to separate yourself from like the bigger ones, the Barry Lyndons, and see.
Yeah, no, you do. And that is hard because once those bars get set, people's appetites, including my own, just want more of that. And what I do like about looking back and then looking forward again is that there are trends and there are styles. And, you know, if you have a second to talk about the Barbie movie, I'm excited that I believe that movie is going to usher in a trend for a while. And there's a lot of that movie that is done on a soundstage in a contained way, but you don't feel that way. You feel like you're in a world. And the production design, it to me, it should be nominated for an Oscar at the very least. It could win in my book, depending on obviously what else comes out, because you compare that to the Marvels of the world, which is stuff on stuff and it's infinite universes and they go on forever. The fact that they did so much tangibly and you weren't jarred, it just was really successful and seamless. So I'm very excited by what that movie is going to show producers, writers, directors, and future production designers, art departments, how to do something because it was successful.
Yeah.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.